Plus, I've been talking with a lot of you people out there over the years, and finally get a chance to put a face to all the voices I've been listening to. But I want to salute each of y'all that are here, first because you have the intellectual integrity to seek the truth, despite the fact that everything in our society tells you to go along with the program and don't get politically incorrect. But more importantly, because you had the courage to walk away from that political correctness and seek the truth where you're here today. I suspect all of you are kind of like me, that you went through a process before you got to this point. The tendency is to see the truth and then deny it because it's too politically incorrect. It kind of reminds me of the quote attributed to Winston Churchill when he said, "Most people, once or twice in their life, will stumble across the truth. The vast majority will scramble up, dust themselves off, and rush away as if nothing happened." And I suspect maybe all of us went through a little bit of that as we started to see what the truth was bringing, because it's so scary sometimes you want to deny it's even happening. But I remember, I'll just start with giving you how I got started in this and the process I went through. With me, it started back in 1963, and I was a senior at LSU, and I was taking my first economics course in monetary theory. And that's the course where you get into this Federal Reserve System and how it works, and you've got these 12 Federal Reserve districts, and you've got a governor for each of these districts, and then you have the chairman, and they meet every 6 weeks. And they make decisions with regard to the interest rates, the reserve requirements, and all sorts of things. But they don't have to report it to the American people. And throughout that whole course, I had this recurring dream. I'll call it a nightmare now. And now I look back and I know it was the Holy Spirit trying to say, "Wake up, boy, there's something wrong here." But in my dream, it was this elaborate boardroom all in mahogany panel. And on the walls were these big pictures with the important people on it. And there was this big conference table, and sitting around this conference table were these 12 district governors and the chairman. But in my dream, they were all dressed up in black tucks and tails, and they were sitting prim and proper in their chairs like they're Miss Goody Two-Shoes, and they would never do anything that was fraudulent or anything. But then in the next scene in my dream, they would suddenly, all of a sudden, had 10-gallon white cowboy hats on. And I would wake up in a cold sweat every time, and I'd say, "What is wrong with this picture?" And but who am I, a 22-year-old student in college, to question my college professor? I mean, he's tenured, and he's got to have more wisdom than I could ever have. So, like the people, I brushed myself off, and I rushed away as if nothing happened. And then I got through my graduate school, and went into as a computer analyst for a few years. But I finally got into, became a stockbroker in 1970. And I got in right at the time when the market was going into a recession. And for about 2.5 years, I was confused because the market and the economy was just not working the way I was taught it should with all my Keynesian expertise. And so I think we lost 50% of the stockbrokers in Dallas at that time. The company I was went belly up. So I was off licking my wounds, and I took a job. It took me out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was just doing my own thing, oblivious to what was going on in the world. But about the second year there, and this would have been in 1978, my wife came home at the time, and she was a legal secretary, and she came home and said, "We're going to go play bridge with Jan and Joey this Friday." Now, I'd never met these people, but I knew that Jan was the coordinator for the John Birch Society. And throughout my years, I would drop into a filling station or somewhere where they'd have some Birch literature, and I would pick it up and say, "This sounds pretty good to me." But then everyone would tell me that the Birchers are a bunch of radicals, and they're communists, or they're Marxists, or they're whatever. And so I was confused. So I'll never forget when we was driving over to their house that afternoon, I made the mistake of saying to my wife, I said, "Boy, I can't wait to get over there and see what learn about the John Birch Society." And my wife just came unglued. She said, "This is a social event, and I'm not going to get out of this car unless you promise that you're not going to bring up and get into a political debate." And I wasn't going to give in. And so we drove up to their to the curb, and we're sitting there going back and forth, and I wasn't going to give in, and she wasn't going to give in. And finally, I looked over her shoulder, and there was these two people peeking out behind the curtains. She was a short little girl, and he was tall, and they were just both sitting there looking. And I said, okay, I promise, I won't do anything. But we went in, and we started talking to Jan. He liked mathematics and music, and I like sports. Now, how long can you talk about the weather, you know? So from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, I haven't said a thing. 10 o'clock, I haven't said a thing. But there's blood coming down my lips as I bite my tongue. Finally, at about 11 o'clock, the girls went back to the kitchen to get us that last a cupcake and a cup of coffee before we headed home, and I lost it. I said, Jan, tell me about the John Birch Society. That was 11 o'clock. 6:30 the next morning, we are still going at it, and I'm trying to defend my turf because I'm an MBA, and I've got all this Keynesian economics that I've learned, you know, so I was going to stand and fight as long as I could, but unfortunately, everything he said made perfect sense. And so when we left, I said, Jan, give me all the books you've got, and I'll prove you wrong, which, of course, is exactly what he wanted me to say. But as I started reading, all of a sudden, I could no longer deny the truth, and it just changed my life. So within a year, I got into the gold business because it gave me a platform to what I call preach the truth and try to wake people up to what's going on. So right after that, I started giving hard money or gold seminars. And what I would start every seminar with was a simple question. And that is, if I had come up here this afternoon and had a table out there and I had a paper sack, large paper sack, and I had dumped a big puzzle on the table and said, okay, guys, let's put it together, what would be the first question each one of y'all would ask me? What's there a picture of, right? Have you ever tried to put a puzzle together? If you didn't have the picture to work from, you don't have a frame of reference, and it's very difficult to put it together. So that's what I would always start with. What I hope to do this afternoon is, one, I want to try to paint a picture from a monetary standpoint of where we're going. So when events start coming down in the future, you will be able to look and see how this fits into the puzzle. When I first got started, I was intrigued with the Trilateral Commission. Someone had mentioned that here earlier. And there was one particular quote that all of them said in a slightly different way. And I'll use Richard Gardner's version. And Richard Gardner was a college professor, one of the original members of the Trilateral Commission. He and Zbigniew Brzezinski were peas out of the same pod. But what Richard Gardner said, and this is a paraphrase, but I think I'll say pretty much what he was trying to get across. He said, quote, "What we must do is take an end run around national sovereignty to erode it piece by piece, to raise the standard of living of the undeveloped countries of the world while we lower the standard of living in America so they can more comfortably be merged into a new world order." And I've always wondered, if I could have taken that one quote 30 years ago and put it up in fine calligraphy and put it in a frame and put that above the TV set of every American and say, look, every time you listen to the nightly news, look at that quote, and then say, where does this fit in to that equation? Then all of a sudden, you know, we go around thinking we've got a bunch of blooming idiots up there, but think about it. They have totally disengaged our whole economy, that got us on the brink of poverty, and not one in 100 even knows what's hit them. Now, folks, that is not ignorance. That is brilliance, because Satan has deceived almost all of us. So what I'd like to try to do is, I'm going to start off with just a brief overview of our monetary system, because I want to set the stage for my main message, which will come later. And what I want to show is that how they have systematically, over the years, undermined the integrity of our monetary system. And then I want to show we're in the terminal stages of that. you know, if you think about it, we've been going through this for year after year after year, and our freedoms just keep ebbing away. But we're still here eating, and we're still here talking. We still have the freedom to be here. So you tend to get complacent and think this can go on another 20 years. I have people say that to me all the time. Well, Ron, they've been doing this for 20 years or 30 years. Why can't they do it for another 20? What I want to try to show is why I think we're at the terminal stage of this and why it's in their benefit to go for the juggler, to end the system as we know it. And then finally, hopefully, I can give you a few nuggets on how you might best prepare to protect yourself from what's coming back. So let's start with the beginning. If you go back to the beginning of our nation and the 13 colonies that fought against the most powerful government in the world and somehow came out victorious, and you had these 13 independent colonies who had fought to do what? Get away from tyranny. And now they're having to come together and form a union that will protect themselves from outside forces that might want to come in and take it back. There was a great fear that Britain would come back to get it. And so they got together and they had trouble forming that first government. And they came up with something called the Articles of Confederation. And that was a very loose-knit government that gave the central government very little power because the colonies were afraid of giving anyone that much power. And the first currency they came up with was something called the Continental Dollar. Now, the Continental Dollar was nothing but paper script that says, this is money, you must accept it. And you can imagine at that time there was tremendous need for the money. So the government started to print the money and print more and more and more. But within just a couple of years, the currency became worthless. And that's where the term came from. You may have heard it in the past. Ain't worth the Continental. So then they had to go back and call a constitutional convention, and there they sat down and redefined what a dollar was. And at that point, a dollar was a specific amount of gold or silver. Now, under that arrangement, with the gold backing, which restrained the ability of government to just print money at will, we had 122 years of basic prosperity where the value of the dollar kept its value. In other words, the dollar in 1913 had basically the same purchasing power in terms of loaves of bread or whatever as it did in 1791 when they passed the law. So in 1913, though, something happened, didn't it? We had two or three laws passed all at once, and one was called the Federal Reserve Act. And the Federal Reserve Act totally changed the nature of both our money and the politics of the government. So let me start with the money first. The first thing the Federal Reserve Act did was create a central bank. Now, they gave it a nice federal sounding name called the Federal Reserve to make us believe that this is a federal agency. The reality, though, is it's a private corporation of international bankers, the majority of them aren't even Americans, and they were given the authority under this act to finance the spending of the government. And so if you think about before this act, when we were on a gold standard, if a politician wanted to get elected, he wanted to make promises to the people, right? But when you're on a gold standard, if you made a promise to one group, guess what? You had to tax the other group to finance the promises you made. So what happens if you did that, then you would get unelected very quickly. But now we've given the politicians or the government the ability to go to this Federal Reserve system, and they print up something called an IOU note, which is a treasury bond or a treasury note or a treasury bill, and they sell it to the Federal Reserve, who can print money out of nothing and loan it to the government. You see, when we had the Continental Dollar, at least that was a fiat currency. The government could print money at will, which was horrible, because we saw what happened to it, but at least we didn't have to pay interest on it, right? But with this Federal Reserve system, you loan the money into circulation, and so now you have this debt structure starts to build, and you're having to spend money or taxes, a good percentage of your taxes every year, just to pay the interest on the debt to these international bankers. But the next thing it did, which even made things worse, was they created a concept of fractional reserve banking. And what that did is all the banks that became members of this Fed could now take a dollar that was deposited in their account, give it to the Federal Reserve System, okay, and they'd say, okay, now you can borrow $10 for each dollar you put in. So now you've created the ability of the banks to just create money at will. And that's, of course, what started us into a series of things which I call the boom and bust years. But think about it. If you're the Fed and you can change the monetary policy to either create a boom to pump liquidity into the market, into the system, and that at any time you choose, you can pull the plug on it, withdraw or drain that liquidity, and you can create economic boom or economic bust at will. Now, if you know what you're going to do, then can you make some good investments based on that knowledge? And that's when we went into a series of boom and bust years. But here's how it changed the role of government. Prior to that point, if you think of the Depression of 1929, the role of government was simply to protect. That's all the Constitution gave. But once you created this bogus system where they could create money at will, and then you create the Depression, that allowed Roosevelt to do what? Start the New Deal. And we started using the government to take care of the people. And once you go down that road, it's just a matter of time before things start to disintegrate. So after the Federal Reserve was created, we had a slight conflict, because we had created this ability to create money at will by these international bankers. At the same time, our Constitution said what? It has to be gold-backed. So we went through this 20-year period, and that's when the 29 Depression came, and then Roosevelt had the excuse or the reason to do what? Declare a national emergency, call in the gold, and let me give you an example. I brought one with me. And it changed the very nature of our money. This is a gold certificate, a $10 gold certificate, and let me just read it. At the top it says, "This certifies that there has been deposited in the Treasury of the United States of America," and at the bottom it says, "$10 in gold coin," and on the very bottom it says, "payable to bearer on demand." Now, here's our current money. Federal Reserve note. One, is a note money or is it a debt instrument? No, it's not money. It's an IOU. Federal Reserve note, the United States of America. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. They've totally changed the nature of our money by doing this. So once they got our gold in, then they continued the boom and bust cycles, and we kept going deeper and deeper into debt. Just to give you a few ideas. First, we had World War II, if you'll remember. And coming out of World War II, did we have more or less debt than we had before? Had a massive increase in the debt structure, right? Then secondly, we went out of World War II. They had something called the Bretton Woods Agreement. And the Bretton Woods Agreement is where the leaders of the world came together. Is it Bretton Woods, New Hampshire or Connecticut? I can't remember. And they met and they created, they pegged the dollar for all the currencies in the world to the dollar. And the dollar was to be backed by gold at the rate of $35 an ounce. So it suddenly made us the world's reserve currency, which now meant we could borrow at will from the rest of the world. As you see, what they're doing now is the whole world has been financing our folly for the last 20, 30 years to go deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. Well, thank you. Soon after that happened, the run on our gold started, because, see, we were sending gold or IOU notes overseas, and they were a claim on gold, which means they were as good as gold. But that allowed us to spend money that we normally would not have been able to spend. Could you imagine after World War II if the president had come to the American people and said, look, we want to spend $6 billion on the Marshall Plan to rebuild Germany. This is the same nation that killed 500,000 of your sons and daughters, and wives, but we need to let bygones be bygones and let's rebuild Germany. Well, if the president had gone to the American people to raise taxes to do that, do you think that would have been accepted very nicely by the people? Probably not. But they did it without even telling us, but they financed it with this bogus money. But that money that was going overseas was now a claim on our gold. And there was a General de Gaulle, I think, is the one that basically led the charge. And he started saying, you know what, I got a sneaky suspicion. Those Americans are printing many more dollars than they have the gold to back it. And maybe we ought to go get ours while we can. And that started the run on our gold. And they did all sorts of things, just like they're doing now, to put off the day of reckoning. In 61, I think they created something called the Gold Pool. And the Gold Pool basically said, all the members of this will commit themselves that whenever gold tries to rise above the $35 peg that we put on it, that you will dump your gold into the market to suppress the price. But of course, whenever gold goes below $35, you can step in and repurchase the gold. Well, of course, the price of gold never went below 35, and they were just dumping their money to defend our dollar. So finally, one by one, they started saying, why should we destroy our monetary system to defend the dollar system when they're abusing the system anyway? So the system just kept eroding. And I think it was 1971 that it finally fell apart, and that's when President Nixon closed the gold window. And on the last day, foreigners took 200 tons of our gold before he declared, we're all Keynesians now. And he closed the gold window. At that point, we no longer backed our dollar with gold. But you see, we've slowly deteriorating the credibility of our currency. And so that started the run on our gold. Nixon closed the gold window. And that led to the boom that took gold from $35 an ounce in 1971 to about 1979-80. Gold hit $870, as Dr. Stan had mentioned, and silver went to $52 an ounce. And that's where I wanted to kind of break off because, well, let me mention one other thing. The crisis created by that blow-off allowed, I try to picture Jimmy Carter in January of 1980. He was about ready to run for re-election. Interest rates were 21.5%. Gold was at 870. Inflation was, 15 to 16%? That's what the government admitted to. And so the economy was in a shambles, and here he is going into an election year. But what they rushed through in this crisis was something called, and you very seldom hear this even mentioned by the hard money people, but to me it was one of the biggest things to send us down the primrose path even deeper. And that is, in March of 1980, our Congress passed something called the Monetary Control Act of 1980. And what that simple bill did was change the definition of collateral under the Federal Reserve System. As I said, the initial system allowed the Fed to finance the deficits of the federal government. So if the government ran a deficit, they could print up an IOU called a treasury bond, sell it to the Fed, and that would finance the deficit. But this definite change in the definition of collateral from accepting federal or U.S. Treasury obligations, they changed it to accept anything that they chose. So now, if you'll remember back then, you had the problem in 1979-80 with the oil debt, where they had recycled the petrodollars, and you had all these countries like Brazil and Mexico and Argentina and Poland and Russia, and you name them, they're all massively in debt to the international bankers to refinance or recycle the petrodollars, and now they were all going bankrupt and threatening to collapse to default on their debts. So at that point, the president or the Fed chairman could call the dictator or whatever in Mexico or Brazil and say, look, you owe my banker friends in New York $80 billion or $100 billion. So what I'd like you to do is, if you got a napkin right there next to you, I know you're eating, if you'll just write on that, I owe you $80 billion, and mail that to me, then I will pay off your debts to the bankers. And that's exactly what they were doing, bailing out the bankers. They weren't bailing out Mexico or Brazil or anyone else. So what I hope I've kind of demonstrated there is, as the speakers before me, they've talked about the tyranny, the age-old practice of first creating the crisis so you can impose your solution. And the first crisis, of course, to just review a little bit, was they had a banking panic in the early 1900s, gave them the excuse to impose on us this Federal Reserve System, because we obviously needed this system to stabilize the economy and prices. Then in 1929, we had the Depression years, which gave them the excuse to do away with the gold standard. And then, what, in 1980, they created the Monetary Control Act, which allowed them to finance the deficits of the whole world to keep this whole Ponzi scheme going. And that's the point I want to make. And then the next point is, after each of these cycles, what was happening? The debt structure that was before became bigger every time, right? And so as you kept building this bigger and bigger and bigger debt structure, you reach a point where it becomes too big to allow it to ever fail. Can you imagine what would happen today if we went into a major deflationary depression? The stock market would crash. What would happen to all the pension plans and their investments? The real estate market would crash. What would happen to all the bankers and the people that are in debt? What would happen to the tax base of all the federal government and the state and the local governments? That would collapse. So the whole thing would go into a black hole. And we'd have a 29-style banking panic and be over just like that. So we have now reached the point, in my opinion, and Richard Russell says it best, he says it's now a point of inflate or die. So I think what I described as a confidence game before, that all of our money had value only because people had faith in it. Didn't have anything back it was just fiat money. Now it's going a step worse. It's no longer just a confidence game. What we have now is what I call a Ponzi scheme. And that is, there is so much debt out there that you must, at all costs, keep the system growing. Think back the last 20 years. Anytime there was a major failure of a country or an institution, what happened? The IMF or someone came in and rushed to the rescue. And because they cannot allow the system to implode on itself. So now I want to get into my main message, and that is this. Economists for years have argued that the bond market would act as a vigilante against inflation. And from my experiences, most of y'all, most of the people I talk with, have never invested in bonds. They're not really interested in bonds. They may have a mutual fund that has some bonds, but they've never studied the bond market or understand the nature of it and how it works. So before I go into my next spiel, I want to take just a few minutes to try to explain how the bond market works. Now, as a vigilante, what they were really saying is that when you go into an economic boom and prosperity, you start to create excess money in circulation. That money would then go into the free market and start to bid the prices of things higher. And that would be what we call price inflation. Well, theoretically at least, bond investors, and this is the reason they call it vigilante, the private investors would say, look, I'm not going to continue to loan you money at 5% because I now know the cost of living is running at 10%. So if you want me to buy your bonds, you're going to have to raise the interest rates you're going to pay me on those bonds. And as the interest rates would rise, what would that do? It would tend to put a damper on the economy, force us into a recession that would bring us back to earth. So as a vigilante, it's supposed to control the inflation of the money supply. Let me try to explain how a bond would work, and then I think it'll help you to understand what my next message is. Let's say each of y'all had bought a bond, let's say 20-something years ago, and interest rates were running at, well, let's say 10%, just to keep it simple. You now have an instrument that's going to pay you 10%. This is a 30-year bond for the next 30 years, right? You can't turn that bond back into the people who issued that bond, right? Because they have a 30-year agreement. But all they have to do is pay the interest on that debt for the next 30 years, and then and only then do they have to repay the principal. So let's say you bought that bond a year ago paying 10%. Come in a year later and interest rates have gone down to 8%. You've got a pretty good instrument, don't you? The bonds that are being issued in the market today are only paying 8% and your bond is paying 10%. You think that bond might be worth more in the aftermarket if you chose to sell it. So as interest rates come down, bond values go up. And it's important to understand that. But the reverse of that, the converse of that is also true. When interest rates go up, what happens to bond values? They go down. So what would happen, let's say you bought the bond paying 10%, and then a year from now it was, the going rate of interest was now 12% instead of the 8%. Who wants to buy your bond? They can go out in the marketplace and get a bond that's paying 12%, and yours is only paying 10%. So what are you going to have to do if you need to sell that bond? You're going to have to discount the price on that bond. And in that case, it would be about a 20% discount. So you can see where we have the makings of a true boom or bust. Now, we can go back and show how the bond markets function very well in that regard over many of the different cycles. In fact, in 1979-80, interest rates, while gold and silver were soaring to the upside, what was happening to the interest rates? They rose to 21.5%. And that eventually forced the economy into recession. In fact, at that point, I think because the debt at that level was so big, once we started to go into recession, it created the fear of a total collapse. In fact, if you'll remember, by June of 82, remember, Reagan had come into power. He would replace Jimmy Carter. And by June of 82, there was common talk around the world that we were about to go into a 29-style depression. And I'll never forget, on June the 21st, President Reagan called a press conference and he said, "Folks, I'm not going to allow us to go into a depression. I'm going to start the money supply growing. I'm going to stimulate the economy, and we're going to create a boom." And everyone read it. In fact, the day after he made that announcement, silver bottomed at $4.78, and within 2 days it was $7.15. In fact, I always tell this story. If you'd have called me on June the 21st, a Tuesday, before he made that announcement, said, "Ron, I want to buy 10,000 ounces of silver," I'd say, "Okay, send me the money and I can have it shipped to you the next day." If you'd have waited till Thursday, silver had exploded from 478 to 715. But if you'd have called me to buy silver, I'd have had to say to you, "Look, the market's been swamped with orders. The dealers can't deliver for 6 to 8 weeks. But if you want to buy that silver, you're gonna have to buy it up front and give me the money up front, or the dealer won't even take the order." So you can see how fast things can turn around once people realize that we're heading down the inflationary route. So that brought us to the point, and here's my message. When he made that decision to start the printing press rolling, have y'all all heard the saying that when the U.S. catches a cold, Europe gets pneumonia? Well, what they were really saying is that the rest of the world is so dependent on trade with the U.S. because we're the biggest consumers in the world, and so if we're in a recession, they're in a serious depression. So you can imagine when President Reagan announced that he was going to start the printing press rolling, you now had a phenomenon that would last for 20 years. And that is, everyone around the world was doing what? Scrambling to create or to compete for the almighty consumer dollar. So to give you just a simple example of how it works, let's assume the Bank of Japan, the central bank in Japan, wanted Hondas to be more competitive in the U.S. market than, let's say, Buicks. Well, how would they accomplish that? Well, they would simply dump, and this is what they did do, they would dump Japanese bonds into the market, diluting the value of the Japanese yen, which, by the way, is where the old thing called the yen carry trade initiated. They would take the proceeds of their yen bond sales and turn around and buy what? U.S. Treasury bonds. And when they came into the market to buy those U.S. Treasury bonds, they started to strengthen the value of the dollar, didn't they? And so we went through a 20-year period where the whole world was scrambling over itself to compete for that dollar, and they were all orchestrating their currencies lower versus the dollar, and it created nirvana in America. We had the best of both worlds. Our dollar was strong. Since we import most things we buy, things were cheaper. We didn't see any inflation because most Americans think inflation is what? Rising prices. They don't understand that inflation is the increase in the money supply and credit, and any rise in prices is a result of that inflation of the money supply. So as the foreigners stepped in and started scrambling to buy our debt, it became a win-win-win situation for them. Because, one, when they stepped in to buy bonds paying 16% in 1982, and a year later or 2 years later, interest rates had come down to 10 or 12%, their bond investments had gone up dramatically, right? Plus, they were still getting a return that was way above the going rate in the market, so they were happy there. Secondly, they had exchanged their currency, the yen, and invested in dollars, and now the dollar was going straight up against every currency in the world. So they made 20, 30% a year just on the appreciation of the dollar versus their currency. And then third, we were selling, taking all of our plants and equipment and everything and doing what? Shipping it overseas to take advantage of the cheap labor, so they were winning on that account. The Americans, on the other hand, were happy as a lark too, because they were buying things cheaper. They didn't have to worry about financing the deficit because foreigners were standing in line saying, we'll buy whatever you got. So remember back in those days, no one even talked about the deficit for years. Yet we were running massive, massive deficits. But as long as foreigners would step in to buy them, not to worry, right? Everything is good. So this process went on for 20 years. But see, it's all artificial, isn't it? And anything that's artificial eventually has to come to an end. So as interest rates came from 16 to 15 to 14 to 13 to on down to like 5% by 2001, they finally reached a point where they just simply couldn't go any lower. And at that point, the party started to end, because now interest rates are doing what? They've stabilized and started to work their way higher. And when interest rates go higher, what happens to bond values? They start going down. So what was a lot of fun for 20 years suddenly is no fun anymore. And so now what you have, the only way I know to describe it, is try to picture in your mind all the creditors of the United States, whether it's Japan or China. Just to divert it a little bit, just last week there was an article that came out by Evans Ambrose Pritchard, who's an international editor. And what he pointed out is that in the month of August alone, the Asian countries, and he said Japan dumped $24 billion, China $14 billion, Taiwan $5 billion, but the Asian countries alone in August alone dumped $52 billion of treasury bonds into the open market. You see the problem that might develop? As Dr. Stan has said so many times, we need foreigners to invest $3 billion a day. Pritchard said it's $70 billion a month. That'll do. And if all of a sudden you find out that the foreigners are saying, hey, folks, not only do we not want to invest $70 billion in your new debt next month, what we really want to do is cash in the chips on the bonds we've been accumulating for the last 20 years. And that's what's starting to happen. What was fun for a long time, what it made it easy for America to keep the game going, is now suddenly coming to an end, and it's going to come very quickly. And so, back to my analogy, try to picture in your mind the creditors of the United States, whether it's China and Japan, or some Arab sheik in Saudi Arabia, or just people that have their pension plans that are buying U.S. Treasury bonds and so forth, right? Try to picture every one of them in a crowded movie theater. I think you know where I'm going with this. And everyone sniffs a little smoke so they know there's danger out there. And they're all sitting there looking out in front of the theater, and they see this itsy-bitsy little red sign that says exit. And they're all thinking exactly the same thing. How in the heck do I get from where I'm at to that exit without causing a stampede? And you can kind of see them shaking their head, and they're all saying the same thing. I don't know how I'm going to do it. The only thing I know for certain is if anyone else runs for the exit, I'm with them. And see, that's where we are. We have set the stage. Our monetary authorities have set the stage to totally collapse our system. And yet for the last 20 years, the bond market has totally failed as a vigilante of inflation. We've watched inflation go through the roof while interest rates came down. So no one is even complacently thinking there's nothing wrong. And they don't realize that once that turns, it can happen very, very quickly. And that's the message I want to give to each of you. We're very complacent that the system can keep going on and on and on. And yet it's going to reach a point, and I think we're getting very close to that point, where you're going to hit critical mass and the thing will start down. And once it starts, it'll happen very, very quickly, just like the 29 Depression. So I think that's basically where we're heading. I said I would try to give you a strategy for preserving your wealth. Now, as everyone's talked about, we've talked about the North American Union and the New World Order. Let's face it, folks, if that goes through, if we don't wake up to what's coming, then we're going to lose everything. I think it was Sam Adams who said, those who cherish their riches more than their freedom will lose both their riches and their freedom. So if we don't save this constitutional republic, this rule of law that has provided for the greatest prosperity in the history of the world, then we're all going to go into poverty and slavery. So just to close on that point, my urge to everyone is that we develop a sense of urgency, that we realize this is something we have to fight with every bone in our body. In fact, I would say this. If we don't stop it 5 years from now, we're all going to look back and say, why didn't I throw every penny I had to myself into the battle to protect my freedom? Because if we don't protect it, then we will lose everything. So that's my urgent request to everyone. But in the meantime, what do we do, or how can we invest our savings? Because I think God calls us to be a good steward of what He's given us. How do we invest our savings so that we become part of the solution and not a part of the problem? And so let me start with this little analogy. I think Mike is the one that said, every fiat system in the history of the world has failed. There are no exceptions. Any money that's based on a fraud eventually will fail. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that the U.S. dollar system as we know it is unraveling and it's in the process of failure. Anyone argue with that point? So doesn't it make sense if you're trying to protect yourself from the demise of this system, the one thing you don't want to do is keep all your money or your savings invested in what? The very currency that's been in the process of being repudiated. And unfortunately, that's basically everything that all of us are used to investing in. It's whether our treasury bonds or the stocks or the CDs in our bank or whatever. Those are all dollar-denominated systems that are subject to an immediate failure. So we're getting very, very close. And if you look back through history, there's also another thing that has always happened. That is, throughout history, the one vehicle, or the major vehicle, that would bridge the gap from one failing paper system and get over the abyss to the new system that's going to replace it has been what? It's been gold and silver. So it makes sense to me that in order to survive this monetary crisis that I think it's in imminent danger of starting. In fact, I think it's already started. I think Dr. Stanton alluded to that also. We need to take a lot of our money and get it out of the paper assets, put it in the gold and silver. But then, as I've been asked this question several times this afternoon, is what happens if the government comes in to confiscate? Which is a logical question. Here's the only strategy I know to give you, and is to invest and load up with gold and silver now, because it is going to protect you from the coming chaos. But, in fact, what I'm convinced, and the reason I'm convinced we're so close to it, is Michael also, and in fact both speakers before me, talked about the North American Union. And I'm convinced, for whatever it's worth, that the North American Union is going to be that next crisis that will give them the excuse, the dollar crisis is going to be the next crisis, which will give them the excuse to form this North American Union. So my strategy is simply this: load up with gold and silver as we go into the crisis. I don't think they're going to call in the gold and silver until the crisis is such a point where it creates chaos. At that point, they may call in the gold and silver, but in the meantime, gold and silver will have gone through the roof. And we can see the beginning of it right now. So gold's up $100 in the last, month or so. Silver's starting to rise. So we're getting close to an accelerating flight out of the dollar into gold and silver, which could drive gold and silver through the roof very, very quickly. In 1979, silver went from $5 to $52 an ounce in 12 months. Here we are, 27 years later, we've got at least 20 times as much paper money sloshing around the globe, and there's more to come. And yet you've got maybe one-fourth as much silver. So if you could show that silver went from $5 to $52 an ounce 27 years ago, and you got 20 times as much paper money chasing one-fourth as much silver, what price could you put on silver today? I wouldn't even venture a guess. It would, you'd think I was going crazy if I told you what I thought it would go to. So as the gold and silver, as your profits accelerate because of the coming crisis, now the challenge is going to be to know when to sell. And I don't know that any of us know for sure, but what I would say is that you set a plan for yourself that when the price reaches a certain point where you can sell maybe a third of it or half of it, you pick your own poison, and get totally, totally out of debt. Pay off your mortgage. Then do you need a food storage program? Sell enough to do that. Do you need a generator? Do you need all these 5 acres in the, all the things that you might need to take care of yourself going into the crisis? Sell off the gold and silver to go to pay for those. In other words, go from gold to something tangible. The one thing you don't want to do is go from the gold, which is going through the roof, into the paper dollars, which are being repudiated. Always remember when I first got in, everyone's probably heard of the collapse in 1921 Germany, the Reichsmark. And in 1921, just to give you an idea, it took 3 German marks to equal 1 U.S. dollar. Gold was priced at $20 an ounce. So, in effect, it took 30 Reichsmarks to buy 1 ounce of gold in 1921. Would anyone venture a guess how many Reichsmarks it took to buy 1 ounce of gold in 1923? 6 trillion? I think you're a little low. I think it was 36 trillion. But who cares? Once you get past a trillion, it probably doesn't make any difference from that point forward. So that's where we're heading. And I just think people need to wake up to the urgency of our situation in America today. And in fact, I would recommend a book. There's so many good books that people talk about. But the one I've been telling people to buy is the book by Jerome Corsi called The Late Great USA. In fact, I go so far, and in fact, I'd say for a lot of this material, buy them as Christmas presents. We've got to start getting the word out to as many people as quick as we can. And for all your friends and relatives who kind of poo-pooed you, when you read that book, The Late Great USA, and they document point by point, meeting by meeting, announcement by announcement, their strategy to create this North American Union, suddenly they have to realize and wake up, this is not something we're just talking about. They are implementing it as we speak. So that would be my urgent request for people. Do I have time to give a little
We've got 4 minutes.
4 minutes? Okay. I'll close with I've given this little spiel. I call it my silver spiel. And it goes like this. If you think about it, gold and silver have been treasures throughout all recorded history. You can go back 1,000 years before Nebuchadnezzar, and gold and silver were the treasures of that age, right? Now, a treasure, by definition, is something you hoard, you don't consume it. So you could document that for 4,000 years of history, the world has been methodically accumulating more gold and more silver above ground. But something desperately different happened with silver back, let's say, 150 years ago, and that is silver, because its unique attributes became irreplaceable in industry. And the first application was in the 1850s when they discovered photography. Well, it just so happens that silver is the greatest in conductor of light. And then in the 1900s, when they discovered electricity, guess what? Silver is the best conductor of electricity. So what happened is, throughout the industrial ages, the industrial demand for silver, which was basically non-existent prior to that, started to accelerate dramatically to the upside. And by 1960, there really wasn't enough silver to meet both the monetary demands, because silver was our money, right? And the industrial demand as a commodity. So that's when Lyndon Johnson came out, and I'll never forget it, because this is the same year I was taking that course in monetary theory, and President Johnson came out and said, "My fellow Americans, silver has become too valuable to be used as money." And I remember shaking my head, because I was writing this monetary course. I said, "Gosh, I thought money was supposed to be valuable, right?" But what did he do? He took the silver out of our coinage, dumped 8 billion ounces of silver into the industrial market, saying, "You industrial users can have it all, because we never liked the discipline we put on us anyway, right?" And so when you dump that much silver into the market, what do you think it did to the price of silver? Drove it through the floor, which in turn destroyed the incentive to produce it, because the mines couldn't make a profit on it. So the mining industry for silver just dried up. Here we are 40 years later, and today even 75% of all the silver produced out of the mines, guess what? Doesn't even come out of a silver mine. It comes as a byproduct of a copper, lead, zinc, gold, or whatever. So here we have this situation where, just as we're about to get down to the bottom of this glut barrel, what was 8 billion ounces 50 years ago, they're now saying you couldn't come up with 100, let's say 8 billion, you couldn't come up with 100 million ounces of silver today. But let's say it's 1 billion ounces. At $14 an ounce, $14 billion to buy all the silver in the world. I'd give you an idea of where silver could go. So just as we're running to the bottom of this glut barrel, all of a sudden people are starting to wake up to what? The destruction of the dollar, the inflation, and what do I do to preserve my wealth? And going back to my initial analogy, whenever people lose confidence in the fiat monies of the world, they go to the refuge of gold and silver. And so I think silver is on the position, it's going to shock the world. I think, as much as I love gold, I think silver will outperform gold at least fivefold. And I wouldn't even be surprised if it performed it tenfold. In fact, there's some people say that silver will surpass the price of gold in the future. So with that, I'll close, and appreciate y'all hearing me out.